Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anne Ball and Alice Bryant. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present this week's edition of the new VOA Learning English series, America's Presidents. But first, scientists have found living organisms trapped in crystals that could be 50,000 years old. The organisms were found in a hot but beautiful cave system in Nica, Mexico. These ancient life forms can be seen only with a microscope. They are dormant, with all biological activity suspended inside the solid crystals. Penelope Boston leads the Astrobiology Institute at NASA, the space agency of the United States. She says the ancient microbes were able to exist by eating minerals such as iron and manganese. She spoke about the discovery recently at a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. If the findings are confirmed, they will show how microbes can survive in extreme conditions. Researchers have been studying the microbes for 9 years, but they have not reported their discovery in a scientific publication, and other scientists have yet to confirm the findings. Penelope Boston plans to do more genetic tests on the microbes, which she revived both in the laboratory and in the Mexican caves. 40 different kinds of microbes and some viruses were found in the underground area. The genetic structures of these organisms are 10% different from those of their nearest relatives. Boston says that means their closest relative is about as genetically different as humans are from mushrooms growing in the forest. The caves in Nica are 800 kilometers deep. They were once used for mining lead and zinc. Before the miners began working in the caves, the area was isolated from the surface and the outside world. Some of the caves are as big as the large religious centers built during Europe's Middle Ages. There are crystals covering the walls. The caves are so hot that scientists must wear special clothing to keep cool. The clothing keeps the crystals safe from human germs or other damage. Boston said the researchers could only work for about 20 minutes at a time before they had to go to a room that was 38 degrees Celsius to cool down. NASA officials would not let Boston share her findings with scientific experts before last week's announcement, so scientists could not say much about the findings. But Noreen Noonan, a biologist with the University of South Florida, said she believed them. "Why are we surprised?" Noonan asked. "As a biologist, I would say life on Earth is extremely tough and extremely versatile." The microbes are not the oldest life forms on Earth. Several years ago, scientists published studies about microbes that may be 500,000 years old and still alive. Boston says those microbes were trapped in ice and salt, not rock or crystal. And now, here is Ann Ball with this week's Science in the News report.
Two vaccines developed by a Maryland company are showing promise in the fight against malaria. One vaccine was 100% effective in preventing the deadly disease malaria. That is according to the biotech company Cineria, Incorporated of Rockville, Maryland, that developed the vaccines. Malaria is a disease caused by parasites and carried by mosquitoes. Parasites are organisms that live on or in an organism of another species and feed off of it or get protection from it. Mosquitoes spread the disease to people by biting on their skin. The World Health Organization says there are 214 million cases of malaria each year, and the deadly disease kills over 400,000 people a year worldwide. The new vaccines work by preparing the immune system to fight the disease. They do this by introducing live but weakened young parasites called sporozoites. They are injected into the body by infected mosquitoes. Both vaccines target Plasmodium falciparum, which is the most common and deadly form of the disease. The more successful of the two trials was carried out in Germany. Different doses or amounts of the vaccine were injected into 27 healthy people who volunteered for the study. Another group of 15 was given a placebo, which is a substance given to a patient like a drug, but it has no physical effect on the person. 8 to 10 weeks after the last vaccine dose, both groups were then exposed to the parasites that carried the malaria. Stephen Hoffman is chief executive and scientific officer of Cineria. He says the researchers were surprised by the results from 9 of the people who received the highest vaccine dose. A second trial involving another sporozoite vaccine was carried out in Mali. It tested whether the vaccine prevented reinfection in the people already exposed to malaria. More than half, 66%, of those who got the vaccine dose became reinfected with malaria within 6 months after they were vaccinated. 93% of the people who were in the placebo group were reinfected. While 66% is not the best number the researchers would have hoped for, Hoffman calls the results a good first step. Hoffman thinks Cineria vaccines show more promise than others because they use the whole sporozoite to help the immune system. He says other vaccine makers only use a small part of P. falciparum to try to get a good immune response against the malaria parasite. He believes this is not as effective as his idea of using the whole sporozoite. Cineria plans more clinical trials of both vaccines throughout Africa, including in Mali, Burkina Faso, Kenya, Equatorial Guinea, and Tanzania. I'm Ann Ball. Kaique Vidal first experienced Brazil's Carnival celebrations as a baby living in Salvador, the capital of Bahia State. Before he was even a year old, his mother took him to his first Carnival event. Afro-Brazilian groups performed during parades in the city's historic Pelourinho neighborhood. The cultural traditions of Salvador have stuck with him, and Vidal, a trained musician, now performs the unmistakable music of Bahia in the United States. He often plays in the Washington, D.C. area. Right now, it is Carnival season in Brazil and other countries around the world. Even the D.C. area celebrates the season. Last week, Vidal, Brazilian singer-songwriter Cesar Paz, and other musicians performed here for a Carnival celebration. They played at Tropicália, a colorful event space named for the Brazilian artistic movement of the 1960s. Performing in Washington and other U.S. cities has helped Vidal and Paz stay close to their Brazilian roots. Vidal spoke with VOA before the show.
Being here now, living in the U.S. and not being able to enjoy Carnival as I'm used to back in Brazil with my friends and family is really heartbreaking. And that was the reason why I decided to start making my own events, Carnival parties, just to get connected to my roots, to my, you know, happiness.
It may come as a surprise, but Washington is said to have one of the largest followings for Brazilian culture in the U.S. This year alone, there are more than a dozen Carnival celebrations in the D.C. area. Here, the season is not celebrated on city streets as in Brazil, where it is currently summer. February is one of Washington's coldest months. So the events take place indoors at theaters, restaurants, and other places. Diverse crowds gather to joyfully revel together. The revelers include Americans from all walks of life and a number of Brazilians. Carnival is one of the world's biggest celebrations. In many countries, activities take place for a few weeks each year and include huge parades and street parties with live music. Carnival goers wear colorful, themed clothing and masks. In Rio de Janeiro, hundreds of thousands of people gather outdoors for these celebrations in neighborhoods all over the city. And as many Brazilians know, Carnival is more than just one big party. Historically, it was a time for revelry just before the Christian religious observance of Lent. Today, Carnival is non-religious and offers a wide mix of cultural and social activities.
Both Vidal and Paz say they recognize the importance of Carnival apart from what is observed on the street. Paz grew up in Rio and has lived in the U.S. since the age of 17. Her music draws on many traditions, including bossa nova, forró, and other Afro-Portuguese and Brazilian influences. Paz notes
that, in addition to all the celebrations, the work that goes into Carnival leads to unity and teamwork. Samba schools, for example, work for 12 months organizing, creating fine, elaborate clothing and floats, and training for performances.
It brings everybody out, it makes everybody work together, and it promotes happiness, it promotes enjoyment, it promotes music, it promotes dance, and it promotes the culture itself, and even religion. You know, there's so many different aspects of it, so I think it's extremely important.
For many of the performers, Carnival is also a time to publicize socially important messages. Rio and Sao Paulo are at the center of Brazil's most commercial Carnival celebrations. But even in these cities, many samba schools use their performance to publicize messages of social or cultural importance.
For Afro-Brazilian artists in Salvador, Carnaval has long been a vehicle for social expression. For many years, local samba reggae musicians have sung about social issues, such as poverty and inequality. The musicians also sing to honor their African roots. But Vidal says Salvador's Carnaval has changed a lot, and those changes have made social and racial inequity more noticeable. For example, wealthy Carnaval goers pay hundreds of dollars to wear the abadá, a t-shirt that helps them gain entrance to an area guarded by security. Sadly, most of the people who cannot pay are the locals. Back in D.C., Vidal performs the socially conscious music of his Bahian roots along with salsa, bachata, pop, and rock. He sings with his band Batuque, which is made up completely of Americans. Having a social conscience, he says, means seeing Carnival with different eyes, but it's still a joyful and unforgettable time.
Yes, Carnival is such a happy, fun time where you liberate yourself to express yourself artistically or just as a human being.
And crowds in D.C. are happy when he jumps off the stage into the crowd and starts singing and dancing with them.
Vidal lives in North Carolina. But, he says, Washington is his favorite U.S. city for a performance because of the energy from the crowds. Paz, too, says she feels lucky to be in D.C., where the people are in love with Brazilian culture.
It's nice. They're very open. They're very happy. They're very excited. And they're very supportive, which is amazing.
I'm Alice Bryant.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about John Adams. In 1796, he was elected as the country's second president. Being second can be difficult, and being the second president of a new country, following a popular first president, such as George Washington, turned out to be extremely difficult. For one thing, Adams did not always get along with other people. He was known to get angry easily and often. Adams also was leader of a divided administration. His own vice president often disagreed with him.
passionately. The situation was the result of a rule in the Constitution at the time. It said the person who received the majority of votes became president. The person with the second largest number of votes became vice president. The rule worked fine for the first two elections. Washington had won the presidency, and Adams won the vice presidency. The two men belonged to the same political party and shared many points of view. But in 1796, Adams' opponent in the election, Thomas Jefferson, became the vice president. The two men were personal friends, but political enemies. President Adams supported a strong federal government that protected the interests of business and the wealthy. Vice President Jefferson, on the other hand, wanted to limit the power of the federal government. As a result, Adams and Jefferson often clashed. Adams also made what many historians consider a mistake in choosing his cabinet. Adams simply kept George Washington's official advisers, mostly to satisfy political opponents. But later, Adams learned that many of his cabinet members opposed him too. Historian John Ferling says, Adams was in over his head and started swimming upstream almost from the start of his presidency. On top of all that, Adams faced a foreign policy crisis. After the French Revolution, Great Britain allied with other European nations against France. They wanted to keep the unrest from spreading to their countries. Adams worked hard to make sure the U.S. did not get pulled into a war between France and Great Britain. But France did not trust the U.S. It tried to interrupt trade by seizing U.S. ships. Adams wanted to resolve the problem peacefully. He threatened military action, but he also sent diplomats to talk with French officials. Adams aimed for an honorable peace with France. It took some time, but he got it. Historian John Ferling says, although the crisis in Europe caused Adams endless trouble, he dealt with it well. Many years later, Adams wrote that the greatest jewel in his crown was reaching peace with France. Even if Adams struggled as president, he was successful in other parts of his life. He grew up outside the city of Boston. His father was a farmer, as well as a church official and town leader. However, Adams chose to attend Harvard University and become a lawyer. Adams was a very good lawyer. In fact, he was one of the busiest lawyers in Boston. His success enabled him to buy a big, two-story house that still stands in Quincy, Massachusetts. Adams also had a happy marriage. The relationship between him and his wife, Abigail, is one of the best known of that time. The two wrote many letters to each other during the years they were apart. More than 1,000 of their letters still survive today. John and Abigail Adams were both passionate patriots who supported the American Revolution. They also agreed about the issue of slavery. Unlike many founding families of the U.S., the couple did not own slaves and spoke out against the system of people owning other people. In November November of 1800, John and Abigail Adams moved to the Executive Mansion in Washington, D.C. Adams was the first president to live in what we now call the White House. They would not stay long, however. Adams was facing a difficult re-election campaign. His vice president, Thomas Jefferson, was running against him. His party was divided. Many Federalists supported other candidates. And some voters did not like his decisions, including creating a permanent army, raising taxes, and limiting the rights of immigrants. Those four laws, called the Alien and Sedition Acts, extended the time that immigrants had to wait before becoming U.S. citizens. They permitted the government to detain citizens from enemy nations without reason during wartime. The laws also permitted the president to expel foreign citizens he believed were dangerous. And they made criticizing the president or Congress a crime. Adams said the acts aimed to control people in the U.S. who supported France. But many politicians at the time argued that the laws mostly affected people who supported the opposing political party. Historian John Ferling says they were right, and he says Adams may have been using the Alien and Sedition Acts to protect his political career, but they ended up damaging his public image. They also raised the question for the first time of whether states had the right to ignore a federal law if they disagreed with it. Supporters of Vice President Thomas Jefferson used Adams' approval of the Alien and Sedition Acts against him effectively. Jefferson's campaign said Adams exercised so much power as president that he must want the U.S. to become a monarchy. Adams' campaign said Jefferson was a radical who would bring revolution to the country. The U.S. had never experienced such an ugly election before. Some people wondered whether the country would be able to transfer power peacefully. When Jefferson won, however, Adams did not resist. He retired to his farm in Massachusetts. Adams spent most of his retirement writing. He even began exchanging long letters with his old friend and old enemy, Thomas Jefferson. The two men discussed their families, their thoughts on politics and religion, and their nation's history. The letters were both personally and historically meaningful. Adams and Jefferson were the last living members of the original Patriots who started a new country. On July 4th, 1826, the nation's 50th birthday, the two friends, patriots, and former U.S. presidents died within hours of one another. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.